save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. This is part one in a two-part interview. It's with great pleasure that I introduce my guest, New York Times best-selling author John Bozenecker, a San Francisco attorney and prolific writer of Old West nonfiction. He's with me to talk about his phenomenal book, called Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde. So great to chat with you today. Thank you.
And thanks very much for inviting me on your program.
Yes, of course. So you've written for decades about Western gunfighters and lawmen. Frank Hamer was both. Was writing this book just inevitable for you?
Well, I hoped not to write it because I can tell you that I first became interested in Frank Hamer when the Faye Dunaway film Bonnie and Clyde came out in 1967. I was just like 13 or 14 years old when that came out, and I was just fascinated by the whole story of Bonnie and Clyde. And like everybody else, I accepted this portrayal of Frank Hamer, played by Denver Pyle, as sort of this bad guy who was captured by the gang and humiliated, and then he takes revenge on them and basically guns them down in cold blood. And as I got a little bit older, I began doing some research on Frank Hamer, especially about some of his early exploits as a horseback ranger in West Texas, and hope to write up a story about that, and really never got around to doing it. And then as I got, this would have been when I was in college, and then as I got quite a bit older, I started meeting a lot of Western writers and authors and became friends with many of them, including half a dozen historians in Texas. And so for quite a few years, I pestered my friends to do a book about Frank Hamer, starting probably in the 1990s. And they would always tell me, oh, he's too modern for us. He's not riding a horse, you know, that you do it. And I had my own projects. And finally, in 2010, no book on Frank Hamer had come out. So I started calling all my buddies in Texas. And they all said, we're not doing it. Go ahead. Because I felt as a Californian, like I was almost a poacher, you know, invading Texas and stealing one of their great stories. But when I got the go ahead from all my friends, who would have been the only people that had the ability to write a book about him, then I had the green light to go forward. So it really wasn't inevitable. I was hoping to get other people to write the book instead of me. That way I could just get the benefit from it and read the whole book and enjoy it and not have to do all the work.
Well, luckily for us, you wrote it. So let's start with Frank Hamer. Where was he born?
Hamer was born in the Texas Hill Country in 1884. His family settled in a place called Llano, or just outside of Llano. His father ran a blacksmith shop, and Hamer grew up in what was then a very remote area of central Texas.
What kind of upbringing did he have? Was law enforcement a career he envisioned for himself from an early age?
No, absolutely not. What's kind of interesting about the Texas Rangers is the Ranger service was often a family affair. You'd often see brothers enlist, cousins, entire families of men would enlist in the Rangers. Sons would follow their fathers into the Ranger service. But in Frank Hamer's case, he never showed any interest in law enforcement. He was a brilliant man, reading the early court records, which I did, and newspaper accounts, the documents that I dug up about his career. It's just remarkable how intelligent he was. But he did very poorly in school. He dropped out of the local school in Llano when he was in the sixth grade. He used to say that the only education I ever got was on the back of a Spanish cow pony. And so he was basically became a self-educated man in later life.
So how did he first come to join the Texas Rangers?
Well, he got involved in a neighborhood feud. He was shot and wounded by a neighbor in a quarrel, and when he was only about 18 or 19 years old. And then the parents sent him out to West Texas to get him away from this man who had threatened to kill him. And so in West Texas on the Pecos River, he worked as a cowboy, and that was his primary occupation. And he had grown up in the wild. He loved to go out for days at a time. He would hunt and fish and sleep outdoors. He once sort of exaggerated, saying he slept outdoors for 6 years in a row. And that is, I think, largely a slight exaggeration. But he was this remarkable outdoorsman. And so, and an expert tracker, an expert writer, he was extremely self-reliant. And so these things all sort of came gradually to him. So by the time he was 21 years old, he volunteered to help the local sheriff in Brewster County, which is in West Texas, to capture some horse thieves on a couple different occasions. He tracked them down. And so tracking animals was very little different than tracking men. And so Hamer was used to living in this very rugged environment, living off the land. And this sheriff was very, very impressed with Hamer's success in tracking down on two different occasions these horse thieves. And so he recommended Hamer as a Texas Ranger. And Ranger met with Captain John H. Rogers, one of the great Ranger captains, called one of the four great captains of the Texas Rangers, and met with him. And Rogers met him and was very disappointed from the accounts he'd received from the local sheriff, who was also a former Ranger. And he was very disappointed and said, "He's only a boy." And Hamer looked like a boy, but he was a lot more than a boy. He became very quickly one of the best of the Ranger force.
So you said he looked like a boy, but he also had a pretty commanding presence about him too, right? Could you describe his physical appearance?
Yeah, he was about 6'3", 220 pounds. He was pretty big by the time he was 17 or 18 years old. And he'd been bullied as a youth and ganged up on in schoolyard fights. And he realized that you could fight with your feet. And one of the other Rangers, after seeing him in a fight, thought that he'd learned the French art of savate, which is fighting with the feet. Obviously, you know, in 1906 or 1900, nobody had ever heard of kung fu or karate. But this French foot fighting was something people knew a little bit about. And this one friend of his said, I thought that maybe you learned it from a Frenchman. And he said, no, I learned that my feet are always loaded. In other words, his feet were his best weapons, and he'd use them to subdue somebody in a fight, or he'd strike them with a palm of his open hand. And because if you throw a punch, you're likely to break a knuckle. But if you hit them big enough, if you're big enough and hard enough and you hit them with a blow from the open hand, that would Hamer would always say that was enough to take the fight out of the hardiest of ruffians.
His first months as a Texas Ranger, was he able to distinguish himself pretty early on?
Yeah, very much so. He was. You know, I say in the book that he was a ranger born. His background of being used to privation, living off the land, hunting and fishing for food, spending days in the saddle, sleeping on the open prairie, these things prepared him as a ranger. He was also a dead shot, widely reputed as one of the best rifle and pistol shots in Texas. And what was unbelievable about his shooting skill, and this is not a myth because there are many, many accounts of this, Hamer could shoot birds out of the sky with a pistol, and then he would then eat the birds. He didn't just kill them for the sake of showing off his prowess. He ate everything that he shot. So he came into the Ranger Force with all these skills. From Captain Rogers, he learned to understand the criminal law. He learned how to testify in court. He learned how to conduct criminal investigations, how to interrogate suspects, how to build up cases. He learned how to work undercover. Rogers even sent him up to a ranch not far from El Paso, where a bunch of stolen livestock were being filtered through this ranch, and sent Hamer in as an undercover man. And he was there for several weeks and convinced them that he was a just a redneck cowboy from Brewster County. And until a guy showed up at the ranch who saw Hamer and goes, oh, congratulations on your new job as a Texas Ranger. And that blew his cover and put the end to that particular job. But the whole story is in the Texas Ranger reports. And so I was very fortunate in that the state archives in Austin still maintains the Ranger records from going back to the Civil War era and even earlier. And so fortunately, many of the accounts of Hamer's exploits are in the Ranger records. The accounts that you read about on the internet, or you might hear at a Texas Ranger get together in Texas, or a lot of those are oral stories, which I usually, oral history, I don't pay a lot of attention to, because as everybody knows, the stories, as they get told verbally, they get passed down from one to another, and the story gets more and more exaggerated. So when I write a book, I rely on, for the most part, on primary sources, which would be court records, newspapers, that kind of thing, and pioneers' reminiscences. But as long as they're written by somebody who was actually involved in the incident, not somebody who just heard a third hand or fourth degree hearsay story.
So throughout his law enforcement career, he would leave and rejoin the Texas Rangers a few times. The first time he left, it was to become the city marshal in Navasota, Texas, right? How long was his first stint as a Texas Ranger?
His first stint was from 1906 to about 1908. And during that time, he really established himself as this really remarkable young ranger Captain Rogers raved about him in his official reports. And the interesting thing, and to me, the thing that made the biggest impression on me was to find Hamer had this extraordinary affinity for the civil rights of African Americans. And this is something that it was really shocked me, because when I began my research, I assumed he was like a white supremacist, like almost everybody in Texas was in that era. But I found in the Ranger reports that Captain Rogers, who himself was an incredible Ranger, one of his arms was shorter than the other arm because of a gunshot wound. He'd been shot several times in the line of duty, and he carried a special Winchester with a curved stock so he could hold it up to his shoulder and use that in a gunfight. And so Rogers was no shrinking violet, and he would repeatedly write in his Ranger reports, especially when his company was sent to East Texas, which was a large African-American population then and now. West Texas, at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th century, very few African-Americans, very, very few. But in West Texas, it was a different world altogether from East Texas, because West Texas was principally Anglo and very Hispanic. Even to this day, a lot of Anglos, probably even a majority of them, speak some or a lot of Spanish. But when you go to East Texas, and especially in that, you know, Hamer's era, it was largely the biggest minority was African American, and I can't remember the ratios, but because there were so many plantations in East Texas, when the slaves were freed, they tended to live where they grew up, and therefore you had this huge African-American population. So starting in about 1907 and 1908, Captain Rogers' company was sent into East Texas repeatedly to protect blacks from lynch mobs. And Rogers, in his scout reports, railed against the lynching of inoffensive blacks and Negroes for crimes that they either had not committed or for crimes that didn't warrant a vigilante action. They were black people in the 19th century and early 20th century could be lynched for suing white people. They might be lynched for not having proper obedience to a white person. Black people weren't just lynched for rape and murder. They were lynched for minor so-called offenses. And so Hamer, during this time in East Texas, and as a ranger, protected 15 African Americans from a certain death at the hands of lynch mobs. And as I did my research, I'd find another example and another example and another example of Hamer coming into a town, saving a black man from a mob. And the most unbelievable one happened in Beaumont, Texas, not far from Houston, where two black men who were accused of raping a young white girl and killing her were tracked by a mob. And Hamer and a police detective took these two prisoners out into a swamp and spent the night crawling on their bellies in the swamp with these two prisoners and protected them from the mob. They knew that if they were captured, their prisoners would definitely be killed. And during the entire night, they crawled on their bellies in this swamp to slink away from the mob that was armed, firing guns in the air, carrying lanterns to try to locate these men. And finally, in the morning, they managed to get onto a freight train and escape to Houston. And of the two men that Hamer protected, one was found to be completely innocent, had nothing to do with it. The other one was guilty of sin and was legally executed about a year later. So that's the kind of Texas Ranger Hamer was. So when this slanderous depiction of Frank Hamer appeared in the 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde, Hamer's widow, Gladys Hamer, was alive, and she was absolutely apoplectic at this portrayal of her husband. So she hired Joe Gemayel, who just passed away within the last year or a couple years or so, and he was the most famous trial lawyer in Texas. And he sued Warner Brothers and Warren Beatty for various business torts, and they got quite a bit of money. And at the same time, she sponsored the publication of a book called I'm Frank Hamer. This 1968 book was almost the result of this type of Jim Crow mentality, because surely Gladys knew that her husband had protected blacks from lynch mobs. The last one and the most unbelievable one happened in 1930 when Hamer and three of his rangers held off a mob of 6,000 who tried to take a prisoner away from them in Sherman in North Texas. And that particular incident is described in this book, but not one of these other incidents of Hamer protecting African Americans appears in this 1968 book. And it just appears to me that this book, the authors grew up in Jim Crow Texas, and they had the same kind of racism that so many people had and was still lingering in the 1960s, even though the Civil Rights Act had been enacted 4 years before 1968. So to me, this was a remarkable buried fact about Frank Hamer. He's generally seen then, and even in 1967 in particular, and to some extent today, he's seen as this big, heavy-handed thug who tracked down Bonnie and Clyde and murdered them in cold blood, and was just sort of a enforcer for powerful business interests in Texas. And as I did my research, I found that nothing could be farther from the truth. And in my opinion, and I think I make the point, I think I prove the point in my book, that he was the greatest American lawman of the 20th century. And I can certainly go into that if you want to and explain, because that statement was criticized by quite a few reviewers, but they don't know what they're talking about.
Yes, you ably make the case in your book. Not only was he a larger-than-life character, but he was a just and fair lawman in an era where they weren't always so easy to come by.
That's true. And to get back to your prior question, Hamer went in and out of the Ranger Service. And in particular, the first time he was offered a job as City Marshal of Navasota in Grimes County, which is in East Texas. And that came about because he and some of the other Rangers were sent to Navasota because of racial unrest. There was a lynching there and some attempted lynchings. So the Rangers were sent in because the local officers were afraid to confront these white supremacists, because in some cases the officers were part of these white supremacy groups. In other cases, they were just afraid because so many of the prominent citizens and politically powerful people supported the Klan. And Hamer had grown up in, like I say, in the Texas Hill Country, where African Americans were very, very rare, and he just didn't inherit this sort of inbred racism that was so common to people in the South and in East Texas. And the difference between East and West Texas is the West, East Texas is the South. And East Texas had Jim Crow laws and Jim Crow customs, and they were enforced against African Americans, whereas in West Texas, they did have all these Jim Crow cultural attributes, but because Hispanics had been promised and guaranteed their property rights through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and through other treaties and custom in Texas, that Hispanics in the Southwest maintained a much greater amount of political independence, especially in southern Arizona, in New Mexico, and West Texas. It was very common to find Hispanic law officers, Hispanic politicians. In Texas, they were called Tejanos. And so what's forgotten today, and a lot of people in the Latino community think, oh, the Texas Rangers, they were called Rinches, which is slang for a ranger, kind of like a corrupted pronunciation of the word ranger, and they would be called pinche rinches, which would be stupid rangers. The word pinche has a much more obscene translation that I won't use here. But But that is a misnomer. There was a lot of mistreatment by Texas Rangers toward Latinos, but people forget or just not aware that numerous Tejanos served in the Texas Rangers. So it's a much more complicated story than most people would know or acknowledge. But anyway, that I'm going by stream of thought here. But I can go into his time a little bit in Navasota as the city marshal, if getting back to your question. So Hamer had been sent to Navasota with one other ranger, and the people there liked him. And a job of city marshal was opened up, became open while he was there. And so Hamer was hired as the city marshal. And that's when he again ran into these white supremacists and had a lot of trouble. And it's kind of interesting that while he was serving as city marshal of Navasota, Hamer befriended this young black kid named Mance Lipscomb. And Lipscomb, by the 1950s and 60s, became one of the greatest blues artists in America. He's considered one of the fathers of American blues music. And Lipscomb left his memoirs that he dictated in the 1960s and 70s, and he tells all kinds of stories about Frank Hamer. And the interesting thing is that in Navasota and other parts of West Texas, many white people doubted Mance Lipscomb's stories because they thought, well, how could this young black kid know this famous Texas Ranger? Well, 2 points. One, Hamer was not a famous Texas Ranger then. He was just a very obscure city marshal of a town that had only one full-time officer and one part-time or night officer. And second, Lipscomb, the stories that he told about Hamer, I was able to confirm many of them through government records or through newspaper accounts. So that tells me that Lipscomb was a reliable reporter, and there's no doubt that his stories about Frank Hamer are true. And Lipscomb talks about how Hamer protected African Americans and from violence, which I already knew about that because I had had plenty of opportunities to read the Ranger reports about that. But Lipscomb gave it a more personal texture to the story, a firsthand account of how Hamer had affected his life. And he talks about him repeatedly in the book that was published based on his recollections.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from 2 Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. I also host the number one sleep podcast in the world called Sleep Cove, where millions drift off to meditations, hypnosis, and bedtime stories. We soon realized that listeners wanted to hear our mystery stories all in one place. So we created Mysteries at Midnight, where you can listen to all new tales every week. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. So why don't you pick a story now? And can you guess the twist?
So after working as city marshal in Navasota, he goes to Houston, Texas. And it's there, I believe, you wrote that about 30% of the city was African-American. Is that correct?
Yes. In Houston was a very racially diverse city. About 30% of the population was African-American. And Hamer was hired as a special officer by the mayor of Houston. And there he kind of developed a mixed record, because Hamer, he definitely had negative aspects of his personality. And one of them is very typical to police officers. Police are very protective of each other. I was a cop for 8 years when I was a young man. I'm still that way. If I get two versions, one from a criminal and one from a cop, I always believe the police officer's version unless I get some compelling evidence to the contrary, because generally cops don't have to make up stories and criminals obviously do. But in Hamer's case, he hooked up with a guy named Jim Dunaway, who was a famous Texas Ranger. Dunaway was assigned as a railroad detective in Houston. And Dunaway caused some few violent incidents, including one where he beat up a lawyer who had shot him in a gunfight quite a few years before that. And Hamer made the mistake of supporting Dunaway, who was definitely one of the worst Texas Rangers of that era, of that period between 1890 and 1920. Dunaway wasn't the worst, but one of them. And so Hamer's friendship with Dunaway is very troubling. But Hamer was a tough guy, and the guys that he befriended were very tough men. And Dunaway was one of the toughest of these Rangers, but he was eventually fired from the Ranger force for threatening his own Ranger captain. So that Hamer never did anything like that. Hamer was very obedient, and especially with Captain Rogers, would do anything to please him because he idolized his first captain. So Hamer basically left the Houston, the city of Houston. He'd been employed as a special officer by the mayor of Houston. So he was not a Houston police officer, but he's a special officer working for the mayor, doing law enforcement work to try to prevent gun violence, to try to prevent gambling and other sorts of bad behavior, which is very common among both the African-American and the Caucasian populations of Houston. So Hamer got fired in about 1914, and he goes back to West Texas. And it's just sort of a fluke that he's in West Texas. He goes to Kimball County, becomes a deputy sheriff there, and he is there when the so-called Bandit War breaks out in 1915. And the Bandit War was one of the bloodiest episodes in Texas history and was an outgrowth of the Mexican War, which began in about 1910 and gradually bled across the Rio Grande to encompass portions of South Texas. And Mexican insurgents, who today are called revolutionaries, depending upon your political viewpoint, the Texans, white Texans, considered them to be bandits. Mexicans considered them to be insurrectionists. But they came and raided across the border. And as a result, the governor of Texas, who was named Jim Ferguson, whose wife, Ma Ferguson, later, almost 20 years later, became governor of Texas. Pa Ferguson decided we need to increase the Ranger force. So Hamer was hired back on as a state ranger and took part in the Bandit War of 1915.
So after that, he would leave the Rangers once more. and find himself in West Texas this time, pulled there by his brother Harrison, who was working for the Johnson family. They were ranchers, right?
That's correct. Hamer's younger brother Harrison had gone to work for the Johnson family in Scurry County, which is in West Texas. And his brother was sort of working as like a cattle detective or bodyguard. And Frank came there to visit his brother, and he met Johnson's daughter, Gladys, who was very petite, very beautiful, very strong-willed. And she had just gone through a bitter divorce, which had ignited a feud between the Johnson family and the family of her husband, her ex-husband, Ed Sims. And these were two of the most politically and powerful and economically powerful families in those two counties. And Gladys caused the feud because while she was married to Ed Sims, she cheated on him repeatedly, and he finally got fed up, and there were several gunfights that erupted, and all these things that happened before Hamer ever arrived at the Johnson family ranch. And nonetheless, he fell in love with Gladys, and that's what sucked him into the Johnson-Sims feud. And she is the same woman that he was married to her until his death in 1955. And Gladys was the same woman who came across as this very prim and proper lady, and a lot of people in Texas in 1950s, 60s, and 70s knew her as Frank Hamer's widow. But what nobody really knew is that she was this Texas spitfire who, when she was married into the Sims family, she shot a guy. Was just this person that just was so incongruous. When I've interviewed family members who knew her as this little old lady in the 1970s, they were totally shocked to find out that she ignited one of the worst blood feuds of Texas history.
Pretty incredible story. Frank Hamer falls in love with her, and then he becomes her protector. As you've talked about, he not only protects fellow lawmen from what he perceives as slander, mostly from newspaper men he has these gripes with, but of course, once he falls in love with Gladys, he becomes her knight in shining armor. And she's a very temperamental woman.
Yes, my friend Bill O'Neill, who's the state historian of Texas, he calls their marriage the taming of the shrew, which sort of Hamer had a very powerful personality, as did Gladys, and we really don't know how they managed to get along with each other, but probably there was a lot of pressure by both of them to try to dominate the other, and the result was they did have a long and happy marriage. So that taming of the shrew, I think, goes both ways. I think she tamed him and he tamed her. You do see after the marriage, he does play a leading role in the Johnson-Sims feud. And the real climactic gunfight of the feud took place in a garage in Sweetwater, Texas, where Hamer is with his brother and his wife and some other family members, or her family with Gladys and her family members. And they run into a couple of the protagonists from the other side of the feud, and there's this huge gunfight inside the garage, and Hamer is shot point blank and carries these bullets in his body the rest of his life, and kills his assailant with a Smith & Wesson revolver. And it's one of the most famous gunfights of that era in Texas. And so Hamer, in later years, would always insist that this gunfight was a result of his Texas Ranger service, but it wasn't. He was not a ranger at the time. It had nothing to do with law enforcement. Now, he certainly acted in self-defense, but exactly how the gunfight happened, there's a lot of arguments about it. But I think the most compelling argument is that Gladys opened fire first, because that was the kind of person she was. She had drawn guns on people. On one occasion, she drew a pistol and had to be disarmed. by other by some officers who were present for a court hearing. So she was a real hothead, and like I said, she was a Texas Spitfire. And so Hamer, one of his other negative aspects of his personality is he saw everything in black and white. And so here he was protecting Gladys, protecting her family, without stepping back and saying, is this proper for a professional law enforcement officer to take part in a blood feud? And the answer is obviously no. However, this gunfight that happened in Sweetwater was definitely not Hamer's fault. He acted in self-defense. But my belief is, and I've got no strong evidence to uphold it, is that Gladys is probably the one who fired first and started that gunfight in Sweetwater.
So this was his second marriage, and Gladys had two children with Ed Sims. So he became a father. And unlike his first wife, who he parted with on amicable terms, but they weren't really compatible. With Gladys, he really found a perfect match.
Yes, Frank and Gladys had, by all accounts, a long and happy marriage. They were married up to his death in 1955. Gladys had two daughters from her first marriage, and Frank Hamer was a wonderful father to them. One of the daughters, Beverly, was still alive up until about two. I think she passed in 2010. And that was one of my biggest disappointments, is that the very week I was booking my flight to come out to Texas to interview Beverly, she passed away. She was just over 100 years old. But she told would always tell people that Frank Hamer was the best man she ever knew. And so he was a wonderful father to her and her sister, wonderful stepfather. So you've got many different aspects to Hamer's personality. You've got these negative things that happened with some of the gunfights he was in. You can argue as to whether they were really appropriate or not. You've got him being a good family man and a good father at the same time.
So one of the stories I especially want to ask you about, one of the most interesting and villainous characters in your book, and that's saying a lot because there are a lot of them, is Rafael Lopez. And Frank Hamer's life intersects with his in a pretty bloody way. Can you tell us how they ended up crossing paths?
Yeah, Rafael Lopez was one of the most notorious outlaws in Utah history. He was a minor in Utah, and he got kind of involved in a love triangle and ended up in a gunfight. And as a result, officers attempted to arrest Lopez, and over a fairly short period, a huge manhunt went into effect to try to capture him. He killed five Utah lawmen in a number of pitched gun battles. Part of the manhunt took place in a massive underground series of mining tunnels. And some of these mines in the Old West had, miles and miles, in some cases 30 miles of tunnels that burrowed under the ground. And Lopez disappeared into these tunnels, managed to escape from Utah. And lawmen kept an eye out for him for quite a few years. And finally, Frank Hamer got a tip in 1921. When Hamer had been promoted to a Texas Ranger captain, a station in Del Rio on the Rio Grande. And he got a tip that Lopez and his men would be coming across the border. So Hamer and his Ranger company went out, and I believe the evidence shows that they actually crossed the Rio Grande, which they weren't supposed to do, but they set up an ambush, and Lopez's gang, this informant, who Hamer, as a extremely astute officer, always cultivated informants, because he knew that in police today, a good police officer today has got to have snitches. If you're a detective, you can't do your job without having some snitches to help you, give you inside information. And Hamer recognized that very early on. So from his informant, he learned that this band of smugglers, Rafael Lopez and about 10 other outlaws, were going to come across the border on this particular night. So they set up an ambush, and there was this pitched gunfight, and Hamer and his company killed this whole gang of smugglers, including Rafael Lopez.
This concludes the first part of the Frank Hamer episode. In the second part, my guest, John Bosenecker, talks about Hamer as a prohibition agent and the event he's probably most famously known for, tracking down and ultimately killing Depression-era outlaws Bonnie and Clyde.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.